Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. What I'm going to try to do in this video is to try to explain a bunch of very complex problems and issues that affect white people worldwide. It affects all of civilization. And it affects the future of everybody. The image that you see on the screen there is a quote from Dr. William Pierce. Dr. Pierce was an American aeronautical engineer, but he became a racialist. And here is an important quote from him. It says, "I believe in the real world. The unforgiving world of nature, in which we evolved through hard and bloody struggle over millions of years. Perhaps it is not a nice world, but it still can be a beautiful world if one looks at it with the right attitude." And that's what we're going to focus on in this video, is the real world. The real world and what has been hidden from you. Most people take it for granted that what is in the mass media, in the news media, is just a bunch of facts, and that the mass media is giving you all the facts in their correct context so that it helps you. But the reality is, and I've learned this painfully through life, that the mass media is just a propaganda organization. It's a propaganda organization for the wealthy. And that rather than coming out and telling you all the truths of life, the mass media hides lots and lots of things from white people. And it goes to great lengths to hide important scientific and historic facts from white people. And there is an agenda against whites globally. And this agenda is to control white people, but to do so by depriving them of certain information that is actually known and proven. The real goal is to stop people thinking certain natural thoughts that would take them down a natural path, and this path would affect somebody else. And that somebody else doesn't want whites to think natural, logical thoughts that relate to their own survival. Dr. Pierce at one point also wrote about conscious evolution, about the fact that we can go down a path knowing full well what the consequences of it will be. That there is knowledge that exists already, and if we operate within certain rules, within certain guidelines, we as a race can go onwards and upwards towards ever greater things. But the key here is conscious evolution. Now, when you understand what I'm going to be telling you in this video, you will realize that whites actually have evolved in many ways accidentally. We've sometimes done the right thing and sometimes done the wrong thing. And it's simply been that we evolved, but we evolved out of ignorance. Ignorance made us do this, ignorance made us do that, but sometimes the things we were doing were good for us, and other times the things we were doing were bad for us. However, there is no need to function in this silly and ignorant way. Because in actual fact, for more than 100 years, perhaps closer to 150 years, we've actually had enough scientific and historical knowledge that we no longer need to guess. We actually know enough in order to determine the best way to live, the best way to organize, and the best way to work as a group for the benefit of the group until the end of time. We have got that knowledge. Yet every day you are presented with all kinds of choices. But if you understood history and science, you would know that no, that choice over there, that's wrong, that's bad. We shouldn't be doing that. Yet we are given the chance to do stupid things over and over again. And that's what I'm going to be discussing in this video. What is the knowledge that's being kept from us? What is the knowledge that others don't want us to know or to take seriously because it can impact them negatively? It won't impact us negatively. It'll be positive for us, but it will be negative for somebody else. And in this harsh world, rest assured, it is not just a case that everybody can win all the time. There are winners and there are losers. That's the way nature works. This man that you see on the screen in front of you, his name is Philip Rushton. But he is Professor Philip Rushton. And Rushton studies humans, and he's written books and papers discussing the differences between races. And the most important difference is intelligence. So this is a quote from Rushton. He says, "The biological factors underlying race differences in sports have consequences for educational achievement, crime, and sexual behavior." And what Rushton discusses are the differences between humans, the things we can measure about people, and how people are different, and how those differences are biological and they are inside your DNA. Rushton is by no means alone. He's just the latest in a long, long line of scientists and academics who've been digging into this kind of thing for well over a century. It's probably closer to more than 150 years. So let me summarize the big picture for you before I show you more detail. You've been told that all people are equal, that all people across the planet are the same. Yet it should be obvious to you that people aren't the same, that people have got different capabilities. Some have got skills in certain areas that others don't have. Some are better and consistently better at certain subjects or topics that others are not good at, and that these results are consistent. It turns out that 99% of all inventions and all scientific progress that has ever taken place in the history of the world comes from people of European descent. In other words, white people. Of that 99%, 2% of it took place in ancient times, and the other 97% took place in modern times. While Europeans, or people of European descent, are responsible for such a vast amount of progress in the world, it turns out that as a general rule of thumb, a rough rule of thumb, that higher intelligence is generally associated with light-colored skin. So intelligence, higher intelligence, is also prevalent among Asian people, but specifically Asian people in Northeast Asia. And historically, it has followed that people of higher intelligence create civilizations. So you'll find civilizations that existed in the Middle East, North Africa, Europe, and all across through to China. Now, one of the questions is, why is it that there is this link between a lighter skin and higher intelligence? And the best generally accepted theory in science is that it has to do with hardship. That people who lived in northern climates, which were very cold, that these people developed intelligence because life was much, much harder than further down, closer to the equator. Furthermore, 20,000 and 40,000 and 100,000 years ago, the Earth was a lot colder. And the areas that we now know of as Europe and Asia were covered in thick glaciers. And these areas were covered in glaciers for tens of thousands of years. One of the key scientists who proposed this theory is Professor Richard Lynn in Britain. So when the climate started warming up in the last 20,000 years, and trees were able to grow in regions that previously had been under the ice, there was an absolute explosion of human civilization and human activity in Europe and Asia. And there were many, many civilizations. You had the Sumerians, you had the Babylonians, you had the Egyptians, and many, many more. So great civilizations arose, and they developed, and they built things, and they wrote laws, and they created science, and they progressed and became stronger. But all of these civilizations also ended up going downhill and collapsing. So then the question arose as to why do civilizations that are advanced and powerful, why do they eventually collapse? And in some cases, people have proposed and suggested that the reason these civilizations are collapsing is because there are lots and lots of other people who come into these civilizations and become a part of them. And that these people who come are actually dragging the civilization down. So the physical makeup of civilizations may actually be changing. The DNA of the civilization, of the people in the civilization, may be changing due to interbreeding. Scientists know that most everything about you is the direct result of DNA that comes from your mother and your father. However, your intelligence also comes from your parents. And it's been established that 70 to 80% of the intelligence of a baby is already present at the time of birth. And that the other 20% is due to, let's call it, environmental factors. But the vast majority of intelligence comes from your parents. And it turns out that if someone, let's say of IQ, intelligence of 100, marries somebody of IQ 80 and they have children, that the children will have an IQ midway between those two points. In other words, 90. So the issue that has been raised by people in the past has been that if you have a civilization that has been created by a group of people, and that group of people then merge with another group of people who are of lower IQ, that this will eventually result in the collapse of the civilization. So the civilization will collapse because the people are becoming more stupid and they can't compete against other human civilizations that are cleverer. So that is the summary in a nutshell. What I will do in the rest of the video is to quickly just take you through a couple of different things that exist, just to show you various bits and pieces of evidence that pertain to the past history of whites and to some of these topics that I've just discussed. Because it is quite shocking that all of us go to school and we are taught maths, and we are taught science, and we're taught many things, but the one thing we don't spend our time looking at is the history of our own people from ancient times to now. And the vast majority of the things that have happened in the past are actually unknown to whites, even if they've gone to school, even if they've gone to high school and university. They actually don't know more than a teeny-weeny fraction of the history of their own ancestors. I also need to just clarify the issue of the lighter colored skin. It doesn't matter what the long-term history of our race is, whether we came out of Africa as a type of black people or whether we didn't. The bottom line is that by moving into Asia and Europe, we lived in an ice age. And if our skin was darker in the past, it was just that it became lighter when we lived in Asia and Europe. That is, if the out of Africa theory is true. Living in the snow and ice results in a lighter skin, and a lighter skin absorbs more vitamin D even in bad sunlight. And vitamin D is critical for your immune system. So let's take a quick jump through history just to show you a handful of the things that you've never heard of. Most likely, things that you would never have been taught in school. Let me now take you on a tour of history in a way that you've never seen before. And we are going to look at the world, and we're going to look at the world totally differently. And a topic that's going to come up again and again is this topic that you see in front of you. IQ. What is IQ? IQ is intelligence quotient. It is a measure of intelligence. The dictionary definition of intelligence is the ability to acquire and apply knowledge and skills. IQ was meant to be a measurement of the ability of people. There are lots of types of IQ tests, but the goal of scientists originally was to measure the ability of people to solve problems and to think for themselves and to be able to perform in the real world. IQ tests are the best predictor of a person's ability. So an IQ of 100 was established as the average. in Western civilization. And then variations of that then have another meaning. A difference of even 10 IQ points is a big difference. And when you get down to an IQ of 70, you are regarded, or used to be regarded, as an idiot, a moron. IQ tests were developed in many ways so that they could overcome even language issues, so that somebody could have their intelligence tested without being able to read or write, and the test would still give a valid outcome. Lots of people try to knock science, but science done properly is incredibly accurate. So in this chart in front of you, this is a chart that someone put together, the chart that nobody dares to mention, different IQ levels for different races. So you see the highest IQ is in Northeast Asia. So note, only a certain part of Asia has got a very high IQ that's even higher than that of Western Europe. And then you see Western Europe and the USA is 100. Then you see Arab and Muslim countries are 83. And then you see Sub-Saharan Africa, 70. Now, this difference between Western Europe and Sub-Saharan Africa, notice that the Arab and Muslim countries have got a higher IQ than Sub-Saharan Africa. And the difference between Western Europe and Sub-Saharan Africa, these Arab and Muslim countries are almost exactly halfway between Sub-Saharan Africa and Western Europe. They are just two IQ points below an exact midpoint. In the rest of this video, I'm going to show you some history. You will then see a whole bunch of very fascinating things about the world as a whole and whites in particular that will make a lot more sense. What you see in front of you is a chart of the temperature changes during the ice age in Europe. There are thick ice sheets in the world in the northern and southern hemispheres, and these ice sheets have accumulated ice for hundreds of thousands of years. So at the South Pole, for example, in Antarctica, snow falls on the ice, but it doesn't melt, and more snow falls the next year on top of the previous snow. And so it carries on for hundreds of thousands of years. And scientists have been able to drill ice cores that go deep down, and then they've got a climate record of the climate of the Earth going back hundreds of thousands of years. And they can tell you all kinds of things that happened long, long time ago. They can tell you temperature, they can tell you carbon dioxide levels, they can tell you all kinds of things from the distant, distant past that we have no records of. So in here, if you look at this chart, you'll see it goes back 450,000 years. And if you look, you'll see that the temperature has been dropping in the last 50,000 years. I put some arrows on there for 50,000 years and approximately 20,000 years ago. So you'll see that at about 400,000 years ago and at about 320,000 years ago and about 130,000 years ago, that the temperature rose quickly for a while, and then the Earth became cold again. And then, starting at about 20,000 years ago, yet again, the temperature warmed up very quickly. And so now we are out of an ice age. But the ice age was just 20,000 years ago. We've only been out of it for a short period of time, in geological time. Let's take a look at a map of Europe, and it's Europe in a way that you've never seen it before. What this map is showing you is the return of trees into Europe. How trees came back to Europe after the Ice Age, because Europe didn't have trees for hundreds of thousands of years, except for maybe very short periods of time. So the map on the top left is 12,000 years BP, which is before present. So that's about 10,000 BC. So what you're seeing there are the first signs of trees returning to Europe. So 10,000 years ago, you can see that trees were appearing in Spain, and trees were appearing in Italy and Greece. And this is very important. This may give us a clue to why certain things happened in Italy and Greece before it happened in other parts of Europe. On the top right, you'll see 10,000 years before present. That's 8,000 BC. And you can see that the trees have started moving upwards into France. In the bottom left, you can see that by 4,000 BC, in other words, 6,000 years ago, trees had finally returned to most of Europe. And then after that, you can see the trees are everywhere, and they've reached further up into Scandinavia by 2,000 years ago. So this can show you that the ice is melting, the ice has gone away, and finally plants can start to grow and temperatures are rising. Here is an ancient piece of artwork, but this is not the kind of artwork that the mass media would like to talk much about. This piece of artwork was found in Germany, and it had actually splintered into pieces. But the German scientists put this thing together, and it's one of the most amazing finds from our ancient past. This piece of artwork is known as the Lion Man, and it was found in a cave in Germany. But here's the kicker. This piece of artwork was dated to 40,000 years ago. 40,000 years ago. So what it means is that even though there was still an ice age in progress in Europe, there were still people who were actually living there in that time. Of course, there weren't many people. The numbers of people who lived in Europe in glaciers and in the extreme cold weren't many. But this gives you an idea that 40,000 years ago, there were people living in Germany. There are many other pieces of evidence that show that people were living in chunks of Europe even before the tree line came back. For example, they found DNA of people who lived in Belgium 35,000 years ago. So these people are hunter-gatherers, and they are living in extreme cold. And for these people to survive is a real problem. And it is this kind of background of our ancestors that may be what led to an increase in our intelligence. That we lived, that a certain portion of our ancestors lived in extreme cold conditions. And their lives were lives of exceptional hardship. They could not live in those conditions without warm clothing. They were already making clothing tens of thousands of years ago. But there is another very important fact about the Lion Man. The Lion Man was carved out of ivory, but the Lion Man was not carved out of the ivory of any animal that is alive today. Scientists discovered that the Lion Man was carved out of mammoth ivory. In other words, there were people hunting the big hairy elephants that were living in this Ice Age world. So what this means is that the people who were carving the Lion Man were busy hunting, killing, and eating an animal that is much bigger than an African elephant. And if you look on the screen there, you'll see the size of a human compared to an African elephant and the size of a mammoth. In fact, humans were hunting mammoths at a hell of a rate, and there were places where they were ambushing and killing these animals in a big way. And these people are our ancestors. They were taking on animals that size, armed with nothing but spears. And scientists have found the bodies and remains of people who lived in Europe thousands of years ago. So in this image in front of you on the top left, you see the mummified remains of a man whose body was found in the Swiss Alps. He has come to be known as Otzi the Iceman. And here are recreations of what Otzi looked like. And they also found the clothing that was on Otzi when he died. Otzi was actually murdered. Somebody shot him in the back with an arrow, and he died on the mountain. So it's actually an old murder story, in fact. And scientists have been able to get the food out of the stomach of Otzi. They know what he was eating in his last days and hours. And they've found bits of his clothing and his shoes and the tools that he was carrying with him. But Otzi lived 5,300 years ago. However, he had clothing, he was wearing trousers, and he had weapons on him, and he was wearing shoes. Scientists know a lot about the people who lived in Europe in the past. One time I even read somewhere, and unfortunately I could not find it again, that people were making waterproof clothing 12,000 years ago. That our ancestors were sewing and making waterproof clothing possibly as long ago as 12,000 years ago. And they've found boats. The oldest boat that they've found is underwater in the Baltic, and the boat has survived because of the ice-cold water, and the boat is 9,000 years old. So scientists have uncovered all kinds of interesting facts about people, and those people who died in certain strange conditions, like this guy who died in the snow in the Alps, others who've died in bogs, and their bodies have been preserved. Scientists have been able to pick up a lot of detail about people who lived thousands of years ago. And these are our ancestors. The technical name for whites that used to be used was Caucasian. Caucasian comes from the fact that the oldest remains that they found were in the southern part of Russia in the Caucasus Mountains. So our more immediate ancestors are a people who came from southern Russia. And these people then spread in all different directions. And they went to Scandinavia, to what is now Germany and France and Spain, Italy, Greece. But they also went to places that whites have forgotten about, like Iran and India. So our ancestors spread into Europe. Now, there were other waves of people that also came later. So over a period of thousands of years, these Asiatic types came into Europe. First it was hunter-gatherers, but later on it was farmers. And there was a combination of warfare as well as interbreeding. And out of this series of waves of Asiatic people that came to Europe, that is where we, white people, the white race, the European race, that's where we come from. We are the end result of thousands of years of this migrating and fighting and interbreeding. And this happened from 10,000 BC up to 2000 BC. But remember, there were other hunter-gatherers who were there 40,000 years ago already in small groups. One of the reasons why the farmers might have defeated the hunter-gatherers may be because farming allows you to have a much bigger population. So farming allows you to have much bigger communities and permanent communities. And that may have given them the edge over the much smaller groups, smaller but fitter and clever people who were the hunter-gatherers, who hunted the mammoths and other animals. So once the climate warmed up and larger groups of people were coming and farming was invented, farming and animal husbandry, these things were invented in the period 9,000 years ago and 5,000 years ago. I think animal husbandry started about 9,000 years ago and farming with wheat started about 5,000 years ago. So once that process started, then people began doing very interesting things. And our ancestors started taming animals. And interestingly enough, initially we were interested in horses, but horses were not the kind that we have today. And originally we had horses for eating. And then later we started using horses to start pulling chariots, and much later we learned how to ride horses. So animal husbandry was the first beginning of farming. It was the taming of animals and starting to change animals, breeding animals, breeding specific types of animals. But the other huge step was wheat farming. The taming of animals and animal husbandry seems to have started much further north in Asia among our ancestors, while the wheat farming started in the Middle East, more or less where Iraq is today. And wheat farming also started as a result of hardship. It was in a bad area, but there were big rivers, and people learned how to irrigate, and that is where wheat farming comes from. Once people could start living in stable societies as a result of animal husbandry and farming, that is where civilization came from. That is where civilization really exploded, because now you could bring large numbers of people together and you could form sophisticated communities. And this led eventually to the creation of the city-state, where a single city is also a nation-state. The Greek city-states are an example. And out of those city-states came science and advanced learning. And that is where the ancient Greeks started getting going with mathematics and science and philosophy and all kinds of intellectual stuff. But while these people were intellectuals, they were also warriors. They also fought. And they took warfare seriously. So you had Egypt, which was started by southern European whites. And whites either started in their entirety or played a big role in the starting of probably all civilizations of ancient time. Either most of the ancient civilizations were created by whites or they had a white component. And I suspect that is the case even in China. But the biggest and most powerful empires that we know about in Europe are the ancient Greeks, the Egyptians, and of course the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire went on to become the greatest white empire that ever existed. But there were many empires and many nations. There were whites who even lived in the Middle East. In the northern part of the Middle East were whites, and they were known as the Hittites. These were proper Europeans, but they were Europeans who were distinguished by having a bent nose. However, they were 100% white and they produced their own civilization. There were lots and lots of civilizations, many that you've never even heard of. And whites lived in many parts of the Middle East and even North Africa. At various times in the past, even chunks of North Africa were white. Anyway, you had the beginnings of mathematics, you had the beginnings of science, and because there were whites who also went to India, there is a huge link between whites in Europe and Indians. In fact, scientists recognize a language called PIE, and it stands for Proto-Indo-European. This is the oldest language family, and our current languages all derive from Proto-Indo-European. And as whites were busy with their new civilizations, they were busy also inventing new things. And they were experimenting with all kinds of things, including even the early bits of steam, power and mechanical devices. One of the most amazing things discovered by scientists is this thing on the left. This comes from a shipwreck. I think it comes from a Greek shipwreck in the Mediterranean. And in this Greek shipwreck from about 2,000 years ago, they found this device, which is clearly a mechanical device, and you can see it looks like a wheel, it's got an axle, and there are all kinds of other things on this device. It is definitely some kind of mechanical device that was built a long time ago. And scientists have been studying this device for decades, trying to figure out what exactly was this device. And if you look on the right-hand side, you'll see a model of what they think this thing was. This could be the earliest computer ever built. This is not a digital computer that works with electrical currents and electronics. This would be an analog computer. In other words, it works with gears and mechanics. And they have determined that this device, which is known as the Antikythera mechanism, they are convinced that this device was used to calculate the movements of the planets, and that if you turn this mechanism, it will calculate the various movements of the planets that were known to the ancients. So this device really is the ancient computer that shouldn't exist, but it's been found. And of course, if there was one that managed to survive, there had to have been many others. And in Roman literature, there are many discussions of all kinds of mechanical devices that our ancestors were busy building. So here we have an actual physical example, but in their literature, there is much more that they discuss, a lot more. And there are many kinds of inventions that existed just 2,000 years ago that you haven't even heard of. I'm not even going to touch on these devices, but I'm just going to tell you there's all kinds of things people were doing 2,000 years ago that you would be amazed at. And it just goes to show the standard and level of thinking that was going on 2,000 years ago. People were building multi-story buildings. People were doing all kinds of advanced engineering. Cement and concrete was invented already 2,000 years ago. There's a hell of a lot that was going on in Europe 2,000 years ago. Europe was already very sophisticated. One of the earliest, greatest conquests by whites using advanced technology took place about 3,500 years ago in 1500 BC. That map shows you the route of a group of whites known as the Aryans. And these Aryans had learned to start taming animals, especially horses. And these Aryans invented the first advanced weapons of war, chariots. Whites had still not figured out how to ride an actual horse, but they had changed horses and they were using horses to pull chariots. And these Aryans, who were chariot riders, they moved into India and they conquered India from the north. And their conquest of India is actually an amazing achievement. They also wrote books. And basically what happened was these warrior whites set themselves up as the ruler of these Indians. And they created the earliest and probably the best apartheid system that has ever existed. And they basically created a religion. And the religion incorporated their apartheid. So you had a warrior class at the top of society, and they created a religion that supported a society where people were classified into different levels of society by this religion, and they stayed in those levels of society. And they taught that society works best when people stay in their various levels. A recurring theme in European history is apartheid. And the apartheid in India is the original apartheid, and unquestionably the best apartheid. But apartheid does come up again and again. In ancient Egypt, the Romans and the Greeks implemented a kind of apartheid that favored Europeans, because Romans and Greeks came to rule Egypt as well. And I'm told that Germanic type of whites almost always prefer some kind of apartheid. But the apartheid of India is amazing because it was based on a religion. So at the top of this religion were the priests and the teachers, and then below them were the warriors and the rulers, And then they began to classify the other people in society. So the farmers, traders, and merchants, all these non-whites, were now at the lower levels. They were the farmers, the traders, the merchants, the laborers, the street sweepers, and the latrine cleaners. And they called this the caste system. So if your parents were farmers or merchants, then you will be a farmer or a merchant. You will stay in your strata. You will not move up or down. You will remain in your level throughout your life. And your level is determined by your birth. But the people at the top were the whites, and they stayed in the top strata. And this religion, known as Hinduism, was the thing that they created. There is a lot of stuff in India that whites created. Sanskrit, for example, is possibly the oldest written language that whites created or took a part in creating. So this caste system, which was the apartheid system, exists in India to this day. And to this day, it haunts the Indians. And its effects are even visible on the Indians to this day. I haven't studied the Aryans in detail, but my understanding is that once they conquered the locals, they were able to rule them for about 600 years before they began to start race mixing. They started having sex and children with people outside of their strata. And that is how the Aryans eventually disappeared. They then bred themselves out of existence due to their mixing with these local people. But we will return to the Indians a bit later in this video. But this is how it all started, with these white warriors who came and conquered them and reorganized their society. It was one of the greatest achievements of ancient whites. And Hitler was a big fan of the Aryans. In an earlier map, I showed you that there were whites who ended up going to Iran, and they were the Iranian pastoral peoples. But what I don't know is exactly what level of dominance they had over other people in that region. For example, in Iran, there is a religion known as Zoroastrianism, and the founder of that is a guy called Zarathustra. But Zarathustra may have picked up his ideas from the Hindus in India. So there definitely were whites in Iran. But what we don't know as time went by is what portion of the population was actually of European descent. So there are some things, like maybe this Zarathustra, that could be white. Because Zarathustra was a herdsman, so he could have been white or almost white. And it is possible that white or whitish people became dominant in Persia. But it's nothing like the Aryans with their apartheid in India. Eventually, there was a Persian Empire, but I get the impression that this Persian Empire, at the time of Alexander the Great, that by then, this Persian Empire, it definitely was not a pure white empire. There may have been whites at higher levels, but it does not look to me like it was a pure white empire at all. And it conquered a region far beyond Iran, far beyond present-day Iran, which in ancient times was known as Persia. So while Iran or Persia definitely did have white people there, it doesn't seem correct to say that the Persian Empire that ultimately resulted, that was a white empire. It does look like it became a multicultural, multiracial empire. But what is of interest for us now is the clash between ancient Greece and the Persian Empire. Ancient Greece really had a tiny population, and they were composed of these city-states, and each city was a separate country. And so you had the Athenians, the Macedonians, the Spartans, etc. And they fought against each other. And these were whites, and they were intellectual whites, and they had a very high standard of intellect and science. And they were a very energetic group of whites, these ancient Greeks. And they definitely even had blonde people among them, definitely. There are accounts of that, of the ancient Greeks having blonde hair. So the ancient Greek city-states were pure whites. These were pure whites, highly intellectual whites. They did farming, they did all kinds of things. They built ships, they were very active, they engaged in science, in warfare, in intellectual pursuits to a very high degree. And at times, they colonized other areas or fought people in regions around Greece, and they started clashing with the Persian Empire. And they and the Persian Empire started having clashes over a long period of time. But eventually, the Persians decided to destroy these ancient Greeks. And they launched a massive invasion by land and by sea against ancient Greece. And the Greeks were in big trouble, and they fought intensely for a long period of time as they tried to survive this massive invasion. Now, the Greeks were not a big population, but Persia was a superpower. And this multicultural, multiracial superpower tried to smash these ancient Greeks. And things went very badly for them for quite a while. But anyhow, they managed to survive, and this was the beginning of a hatred between these ancient Greeks for the Persians, because the Persians came in large, large numbers, and the sea battles were enormous, and the land battles were big. The Persians vastly outnumbered the Greeks, but the Greeks put up very stiff resistance, fighting all the way. However, later, Alexander the Great came into being. Alexander the Great started out by conquering all the other whites in Greece and uniting them under his particular nation, which was Macedonia. Alexander the Great had been brought up to believe in conquest. Whites before Christianity were very big on conquest. The Romans were big on it, and the Greeks were big on it. And they saw all kinds of conquest of other people as a good thing. And Alexander the Great was trained in warfare, and he was given an elite education by the best. And he came out of there as a young man, keen as hell to get stuck into the enemies of Greece, namely the Persians. Alexander then set off and eventually ended up fighting the Persians, and he engaged in one of the most, if not the most, energetic campaign ever waged by white men ever in history. With his army, he went and he fought for 10 years, and that map that you see there shows the path that his army took. As he fought the Persians in Anatolia, fought them in the Middle East, went and conquered the Egyptians, then went back and smacked the Persians, and he just carried on conquering. Alexander the Great was the white guy who just couldn't stop conquering. In fact, he would probably never have stopped, but his troops, who stayed with him for 10 years, 10 years of non-stop campaigning and fighting, eventually his troops basically threatened to rebel against him. By that time, he'd already conquered into India. The Aryans were no more. The Aryans were gone, bred out of existence. But here was Alexander the Great reaching India and smacking Indian armies. So this map of the conquests of Alexander the Great over a period of 10 years, this is probably one of the greatest campaigns, perhaps the all-time greatest campaign of a single army of whites ever. And make no mistake, the terrain they went through was a nightmare. Some parts of the Iranian or Persian terrain, the mountains, were incredibly high, very cold, very nasty. But these Greeks just kept on fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting. You could say that this was the next enormous race war that whites won. And it's also an example that a small white nation, small white militant nation, could smash up and fight and break a far superior, much bigger empire that is composed of non-whites or not pure whites. So the tiny Greek nation states led by Alexander smashed a superpower. Everybody thought the Greeks couldn't do it, but the Greeks not only smashed their superpower enemy, they went on to conquer Egypt and all sorts of other areas all the way into India. This was an incredible feat. And so we could say this is the second great racial conquest of the European people. The first being the Aryans in India. Something that you should watch on these maps that I'm showing you of these invasions is notice that in those days, white armies could travel further and fight further than modern armies. Take a close look at that. There is no army ever since then that managed to go that kind of distance. And it's got to do with many factors that come into play, including population density or a low population density. Nowadays, people associate ancient Egypt with being a non-white state, but that is not true. Scientists have studied the DNA of mummies, they've dug into the history, and ancient Egypt definitely had a lot of white links. There are pharaohs whose DNA has been studied and found to be European. I think they even found red hair in one of the ancient mummies. Red hair is definitely European. There is a lot of evidence that whites played a role in ancient Egypt for a long time. It is possible that ancient Egypt started out as much more white, if not completely white, and that over time, because ancient Egypt lasted thousands of years, and that over time, ancient Egypt became more and more multicultural and it became more black. Eventually, the Nubians from the south, who are blacks, also started coming into ancient Egypt and even reached high positions. The pyramids of Egypt also looked different to what you see them as today. They used to actually have a white covering, so they were very beautiful actually. And there's a lot of sophisticated technology that went on in ancient Egypt. There was advanced science, advanced medicine, and very advanced engineering. And scientists have even found various writings, including the diary of somebody, a high-ranking official, who worked on the pyramids. The pyramids were actually built by professional, skilled laborers, and they found the places where they lived, and they also found various inscriptions and things, almost like graffiti that they wrote in their spare time. But as time went by, and ancient Egypt was strong and powerful and wealthy, all kinds of other people started moving into it, taking part in it, etc. And that is why, like I say, later on, I think there was even a pharaoh who was black, etc. So it's like when these civilizations start, they are started by intelligent, energetic people who have a high IQ, who are very clever, very determined, they solve lots of problems. And then, as the centuries and thousands of years go by, the quality of the people inside the civilization declines. So by the time the ancient Greeks become a power, and by the time the Romans become a power, ancient Egypt has already existed for extremely long periods of time. It is no longer the intellectual powerhouse that it once was, but because it has survived so long, it is extremely wealthy, and it looks great and grand and awesome. And going to Cairo is like going to New York or London back then. So Egypt, in the eyes of the Greeks and the Romans, Egypt looked like an incredible superpower. But by then, it had already rotted on the inside and was no longer what it appeared to be. After Alexander the Great had conquered his empire fell apart over a period of 100 years. Alexander the Great may have been a great warrior, but he made mistakes when it came to people. And his mistakes were very similar to modern liberalism. So even though he'd conquered this tremendous empire, the fact is that when it fell apart, it wasn't any longer under the control of Greece. It broke up into its constituent parts of the people in the areas that lived there, the local chieftains, the local warriors and strongmen. And so he'd conquered this incredible empire, and when it collapsed, everything was gone and nothing belonged to Greece. It is very similar to the British Empire, where the British had a huge empire, ruled an enormous part of the Earth's surface, and then overnight it is lost to all the non-whites who are part of it, and none of it belongs to Britain, and Britain can't defend any of it. So the military stuff was great, but the politics sucked, and all that effort disappeared within 100 years. Then along comes the next set of conquerors, the Romans, and the Romans did a much better job. And as you can see in the top right of the image, I've got a quote from Julius Caesar. It is Veni, Vidi, Vici, or Vici, and it is, I came, I saw, I conquered. And that was the attitude of the Romans. And back then, whites had this desire, this tremendous desire to conquer. They went at it with great determination. However, the Romans were not just a bunch of people out to conquer. They had a very lovely society, but we're not going to go into that now. They had great values and they were good people, they were strong people, and they totally believed in themselves. They were actually very religious. The Romans were pagans, but they were extremely religious pagans. They took their pagan rites very, very seriously, and they would not do things if the gods did not approve of it. They were extremely religious, extremely conservative, and they stuck to their standards. This may be one of several reasons as to why the Romans lasted as long as they did. And they are the greatest example of European power that ever existed. The Romans were fantastic in many ways. But what we're going to look at here quickly is the Roman conquest of Egypt. You can see Egypt there in the bottom right of the map. And by the time that the Romans came to conquer Egypt, it is very interesting what was noted by historians. The Romans at that point in time were not that wealthy and were not that strong. Again, like in the time of the Greeks, Egypt was this thriving, powerful, super rich, super powerful state. And then the Romans and the Egyptians got stuck into each other, and the Romans went and clobbered them and conquered them. But the Romans who conquered this superpower, this extremely wealthy civilization, these Romans were themselves rather poor. They were just very militant, and they lived in their little wooden houses, and they didn't have anything like the wealth and glory of the Egyptians. So you've got this glory in this multicultural, worn-out Egyptian civilization, but these whites are poorer, but they're militant and they're determined. And they come and they smash the Egyptians and they conquer them and they control them. The Roman Empire eventually collapsed. The Roman Empire collapsed and Christianity rose. And it is the only time that white people all believed in the same religion. But there were many who did not convert willingly and they had to be killed by the Christians. But eventually all of Europe became Christian. And all of Europe lived in the remains of the Roman Empire. However, an amazing stupidity descended upon whites. And can you believe that for 1,000 years, white people completely and utterly forgot everything about the Roman and the Greek empires and the Romans and the Greeks as a people? The whites of Europe actually totally lost all their knowledge of Rome and Greece, even though they were living in the midst of what had once been the Roman Empire and the Greek nation states. So 1,000 years of stupidity, of lack of knowledge of history, overtook whites. And then in 1500, whites began to rediscover their past. They actually found the texts of the Romans and the Greeks that had been kept by Muslims. And by rediscovering Rome and Greece in 1500, that caused whites to change massively. And the very computers and devices that you are using to watch this video is a direct result of the Renaissance. And everything that you have in your house, your car, your electricity, everything, all of that is a result of the Renaissance. And the Renaissance basically was the rediscovery of Roman and Greek knowledge. And the rediscovery of Roman and Greek knowledge caused whites to start engaging in science and engineering like they had not done in a very long time. But now they are Christians who are rediscovering the amazing wonders of Roman Greece, and the logic and the science and the facts and the thoughts and the experience that had been built up by the Greeks and the Romans. And it spread across Europe, and it caused an incredible explosion of white energy. And this led to all kinds of new science. And the next thing you know is the Portuguese and the Spanish are busy building sailing ships and designing new kinds of ships, and they are starting to explore. And the next great racial conquest were the Portuguese and the Spanish as they headed westwards. They were going westwards because they were looking for a way to get to India and Asia, because for very long periods of time, whites had been trading with the Asians, but they'd been trading over long land routes. The ancient Greeks had known that the earth is round, and they'd even measured and estimated the size of the earth with an amazing accuracy. So part of the motivation to head westwards was the notion that maybe if they sailed westwards, they could get to India. What they didn't know was that North and South America was out there. Other whites had already reached North and South America, especially the Vikings. The Vikings had already gone to North America a few centuries earlier. And I'm not going to go into the history and the possibility that whites might have reached North America 20,000 years ago. I'm not going to go into that here. We're just going to work with current history. We'll return to that topic. And I have done a video quite a long time ago about the whites from Asia who managed to get to New Zealand 2,000 years ago. So I'll return to those topics later. But in this particular thing, we're looking at big picture things, looking at what whites achieved as a group. So armed with the knowledge and science of the Renaissance, the Portuguese and the Spanish especially started really setting out to explore the world and get to Asia. And instead, Christopher Columbus discovered America. The next great racial conquest of our race was North and South America. But the first people to really get stuck into it were these Spanish conquistadors. On this map that you see here, green is Portugal and blue is Spain. The Portuguese and the Spanish decided to reach an agreement as to which territories they would take, and the Portuguese were to take the easternmost territories and the Spaniards were to take the westernmost territories. Now, all whites make mistakes. They come up with an idea, but then they make a mistake. And the mistake that the Portuguese and especially the Spanish made was that when they went to North and South America, only the white men went. And you'll see the significance of that shortly. But anyway, the Spanish conquistadors then went to Latin America and South America, and they discovered that there are these non-white empires, the Incas and others. And there were a couple of Spaniards who were very determined, and they decided to actually fight these locals and conquer them. And so we have the first great Christian conquests of modern times. The entire Inca Empire was destroyed by just a small Spanish army. And these energetic Spanish went about conquering all across Latin America and South America. But they didn't take their wives with them. They didn't take white women with them. So they then took wives from the locals, and they started breeding with the locals. This happened in Latin America and South America and Mexico. But later, large numbers of whites started moving to North America, and they took their women with them. And they were whites, initially English and Dutch, but later on whites from all over Europe, including Norway, Germany, etc., started moving into North America. And North America became the greatest white conquest ever. And what was good about North America in America and Canada is that the whites brought their women with them, and the whites kept coming, and they kept building up their population and expanding. And eventually they destroyed and took over all the existing territory in North America. But the Spaniards need a special place in our history, because the Spaniards were small armies of determined white men, and they conquered incredible amounts of territory. But their biggest problem was that they didn't take their women with them. And you will see the results of that. We'll discuss that. And so whites continued to conquer and colonize the world until it reached its peak in 1914. By then, whites had also settled New Zealand again, and they took over all of Australia. But North America and Australia were totally taken over by whites, and whites brought their women, and they brought in big populations, and they were able to become the majority. Europe managed to colonize all of Africa in just 20 years, but it was a weak kind of colonization, because Africa was full of sickness and problems, and not many wanted to live there. But even so, whites totally took over all of Africa except for Ethiopia. Ethiopia, I think, was referred to as Nubia in the time of the Romans. I think Ethiopia was the only country that was not colonized originally, though Mussolini in World War II came and smashed Ethiopia for a short period of time. But the problems in Africa and South America related to the white population not being high enough. So South Africa got the biggest white population in Africa, the biggest white population in Africa. But 1914 is really the high point of white expansion. The British managed to reconquer India. So India yet again fell under white rule for a time. But unlike the Aryans, the British did not have much of a population there, and they were later chased out. Whites were really chased out of Asia and Africa as a result of communism coming into power in Russia and China. The white populations in their colonies in Asia and Africa were too small. And so when the local non-whites rose up against them and wanted their own independence, whites just couldn't hang on to it. And in southern Africa, in South Africa, Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia, and Southwest Africa, whites put up quite a fight for a couple of decades, starting in the 1960s, in order to try to hold on to that territory. But we just weren't enough. Plus, Europe and America were no longer really interested in colonialism. So, in a nutshell, we've seen how whites have expanded through the world and what whites did in certain regions. But white conquest of non-whites has been pretty easy, except for Asia. In Asia, we've got a large number of people, and whites have had links to Asia, and while there's been a big population base in Asia, there's also been a big population base in Europe for a long period of time. So you have these two hubs of major populations, Asia on the one hand and Europe on the other hand. But it is Europe that actually ends up colonizing and expanding more, but not always able to hold on to what it has managed to conquer. And it's simply a numbers game. In every instance, it's really a numbers game. Very small numbers of whites go there. And we will now look at the results of all this white activity that has gone on for thousands of years. What is the end result of all this? So let's go back to India. India, where the Aryans conquered. India, where the Aryans created the religion and created their own apartheid. Where they had split the people and where they had kept a caste system going, and then later they gave in to the impulse of interracial breeding. India today is not under white European control, and Indians don't see themselves as being Europeans. But Indians do know their history, and they do know that they had a caste system, and they even believe in the religion of Hinduism. There are even Indians who dispute the notion that whites once conquered India. They dispute it. They say it didn't happen. But since whites are Caucasians and whites are actually a Asiatic people, in a sense, because we come from southern Russia, we spread in all kinds of directions, as you saw, India, Iran, and we even headed in other directions. But if you look at the Indians today, you'll find an interesting thing. You'll find that in India, the people who have the highest social status in India have got lighter skins. And not only that, but the northern Indians, the Indians who are in the areas where the Aryans invaded and settled the most, if you look at them, you'll actually see they look amazingly European-like. Take a look at these various images that Indians have put out about themselves, where they've noticed that northern Indians and southern Indians don't look the same. The northern Indians have got faces that are more angular and straight, and their skins are lighter in color. The southern Indians have got rounder faces and their skins are much darker. And the remnants of their caste system is still partly in place, and the higher ranking Indians, the people of higher castes, have got lighter skins. So the old apartheid of the Aryans still has left a massive mark on the Indians to this day. And the genetics of the Aryans has left its physical mark on the northern Indians to this day. And you can look around and you'll see that lots of Indians, men and women, who are rich or in high status, they look amazingly European. And that, my friend, is the result of racial intermarriage from a long time ago. The DNA that they got from the Aryans is still in their blood. It may have been intermixed with others since then, but they are still benefiting from the DNA of those ancient chariot warriors, even if they don't believe that that event took place. In the same way that modern Egyptians don't really want to imagine that whites may have been the key component in creating their civilization. Asia is huge, and whites wandered around all across Asia. And there are certain places where the mummified remains of people have been found, and scientists have looked at it, and they discovered that these are white people. There were white tribes in ancient China. There were other whites who were traveling through cold, dry deserts, and they died in those places, and their bodies were mummified. And they died a long time ago, but we can see them in their original clothing, even though some of them died thousands of years ago. And if you look across Asia, you will find in all kinds of places, you'll find people who look very European-like. And sometimes there are small tribes who have got people who look very European-like. There are some people who are thought to perhaps have been related to some of those Greeks from Alexander the Great's time. But I think that mostly we are seeing either the results of the Aryans or other whites in the times of the Aryans who may have traveled further. Whites traveled a lot in ancient times, and there was even talk that some Romans might have reached China. But if you look in various places in Asia, you'll see little bits and pieces, what appear to be remnants of places where whites lived and became part of the population and intermarried, but you can see that the DNA is still showing after all these centuries. Some specific places where you see it, like I say, in northern India, but also certain places in Pakistan, maybe Mongolia, and even Japan. Before the current Japanese settled in Japan, there was another group of people in Japan, and they still exist in very small number, and they look very white. So there may be remnants, all kinds of remnants, of whites who traveled or conquered or moved and lived and then interbred with the locals, and then the whites bred themselves out of existence, but hundreds and thousands of years later, we can still see the results of the DNA among those population groups. And it is possible that whites may have done other things or played other roles in China or Mongolia that we don't really know. Like, for example, Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan is quite a mystery. Genghis Khan is the greatest conqueror that came out of Asia, but he wasn't Chinese, he was Mongolian. And there seem to be suggestions that Genghis Khan may have been partly European. So it is possible that there are people in ancient history that we think of as Chinese or this or that, but they may actually have European DNA in them. They might actually have benefited from the DNA of whites. Now let's put all that history together. And now that you understand who did what where, now you can go and take a look at a map of the world and you start to see the world in a whole different way. You start looking at the world from a racial perspective. This map that you see in front of you is a map that was drawn up in 1920 by an American called Stoddard. Stoddard was very much a racialist, and Stoddard was trying to figure out which areas are controlled by which races, who is the most dominant in the world. And the red, the bright red, are the whites, the Europeans. And Stoddard defined the races in his own way. He defined white and yellow, yellow being like the Chinese. And then he had brown and black and American Indian. So if you look at that map, you'll see that all of Europe and Russia is red. So those are the European people. Then you can see that North America is mostly red, except down near Florida and the East Coast, where he's changed it to brown, or a kind of a mixture. He may have superimposed one color on top of another. Then you can see Australia and New Zealand are white. And look at India now. India and Persia and the Middle East, where whites used to be, and where whites intermarried with others, and whites are no longer the majority there, and they've been bred out of existence, but the locals have benefited from their DNA. And you will see as I explain more. So in the areas where whites were totally outbred, where they were immersed in bigger populations, the whites later completely disappeared. They're gone. So all we have are the history of the Aryans and the whites who reached Iran or Persia. And we know that there were whites in Egypt. We know the Hittites ruled the north of the Middle East, and all those whites are gone. They've been replaced by a mixed race. They've been mixed up and they're gone. Interestingly enough, if you look carefully at Stoddard's map, in the very top north of Africa, close to Spain, you'll see that he actually colored it as white, red meaning white. And whites used to actually occupy huge chunks of North Africa. Whites ruled and lived in North Africa more than once in the past, and they ruled the whole area. But it's interesting to see this little smidgen of whites left in the top northwest of Africa. Now, if you look at Africa, Africa is the black race. But you'll see that as Africa, as the blacks go northwards, you see it ends up in this brown mixture, and the blacks themselves have got a limitation of how far north they go, and also how far to the east they go. Like the Horn of Africa is brown. Then if you look at South Africa, you look on the southern tip of Africa, you'll see it's not a pure red, but there is clearly some red there because there is small white presence in southern Africa at that time. But let's take a good look at Latin America and South America. It turns out that there are chunks of South America that actually have got whites in them, like the bottom part of Brazil and Argentina, and it might be Chile. And you can see that there are some chunks of South America that actually have lots of whites. There's actually a big white population there. I looked into it some years ago and I concluded that there must be at least 100 million whites in South America, at least. Whereas in Africa, we're down to 4.5 million whites. So we are very much on the edge. But in South America, there's like about 100 million pure whites there. However, the vast majority of South America is now a brown mixture. There is black in South America, and those blacks, I think, are the result of slavery. Do you know that about 60,000 years ago, blacks actually lived in South America? There was a time when blacks lived in South America. I don't know how they got there, but blacks did live in South America. And those blacks in South America went extinct. The blacks who lived in South America went extinct. I think they were killed by Asians who came down from up in Canada, there across the Bering Strait, when the Asians moved into North America and South America. I think the Asians that came into North and South America, who later became known as the Amerindians, those Asians, I think they genocided the blacks who were in South America. However, there are blacks in South America now, but those blacks are there as a result of slavery. More blacks were sold into slavery to go to South America than to North America, but you won't hear about it because the liberals are trying to rather extort money out of North Americans. There's more money to steal from them, so they make a big issue of slavery. But those Spaniards who went to South America could have been completely white, like North America, but they interbred with the locals, and so that place is now non-white. And just like India and the Middle East and so forth, these places that become non-white, that become mixed race, they don't see themselves as offshoots of whites or linked to whites. They see themselves as totally different, and they are even against whites. They are even anti-white. But that was Stoddard's map from 1920. Here is a much more up-to-date map of the world, and it's the best that I can find that shows whites and the descendants of whites. So how this works is that areas that are totally, totally white are actually black. And then that means that 99% of the people in that area are whites. And then as you move away from that and the percentage of whites in the population becomes less and less, then you get this red color, a dark red, then a lighter red, pink, etc. So you'll see that Europe and Eastern Europe and Scandinavia is extremely white. And you'll see that this is true right into huge chunks of Russia. And then as you go to France and Britain, you'll see the percentage of white becomes less. You'll see that America is even less white. And then take a look at Australia and New Zealand, very white. But look at that fascinating place, South America. And in South America, you'll see that there are percentages of whites mixed in and living amongst the browns. But the main area that is white is like Argentina, Chile, and southern Brazil. And then you can see a tiny smidgen of whites in South Africa and in Namibia. But if you look at the rest of the world where it is white, the percentage of whites in Africa, in the Middle East, in Iran, in India, in China, etc., the percentage of whites living there is non-existent. It is, for all intents and purposes, non-existent. I'm not sure if it means that they make up less than 5% of the population, but there are virtually no whites in the general population as a percentage of the population, Africa, India, etc. I think this map shows the percentage of people in the population that are true whites. And as you can see, whites as a force don't exist in those regions. So now with all that background, let's go back and look at an IQ map of the entire world. And now we see a lot of interesting things, and we also see lessons from history and the long-term consequences of population migration, movement, interbreeding, conquest, etc. So like I said right in the beginning, the highest IQ is in the northern regions of the world, and it is because the Europeans and the Asians lived in very cold climates. And very cold climates and ice ages may be the key thing that shaped our IQ. In other words, hardship, extreme hardship, shaped our IQ and made us cleverer. That is the basic point that Professor Richard Lin and others have made. But we can actually figure out many things about this map just from our knowledge of history and IQ and various movements in history. So the continent with the dumbest people on it is Africa. And there you can see the IQs measured per country. This is a map that was done by Lin and others back in 2002, 2006, etc. They worked and they put together these IQ scores in various places. Rushton, I see, is also one of the contributors here. So this is what we know about how clever people in different countries are. And these are now the average IQs for those countries based on the racial mixtures in those countries. And it turns out that Africa is the dumbest continent on Earth. And if we look at this notion that the ice ages, the extremely cold climates, made people cleverer through tens of thousands of years of extreme hardship, then there are other studies that I've come across where they've mentioned that it can be shown that the further you get away from the equator, and let's just focus on the map of Africa for now, the further you get away from the equator, the more IQ goes up. In other words, the dumbest people are the people who lived in the areas where life is the easiest. So in Africa, round about the equator and Central Africa and so forth, the climate was an easy climate to live in. Whereas the people who lived further and further north had nightmares to live through. But now you may ask, hold on. If that is true, then why doesn't South America also have a very low IQ? Well, we know a bunch of things about South America. I have mentioned that 60,000 years ago, black people did live in South America. But the people that came to be known as the American Indians in North and South America, who are regarded as, let's call it the Native Indians, what I didn't show you is that those people are actually Asians. They are people who came from Asia and they came across the Bering Strait, down through Canada, down through America, at the end of the Ice Age. When the Ice Age ended, when the last Ice Age ended, these people moved across into Canada, into America, down through Latin America, and I think that they genocided the blacks in South America. So South America's non-whites are of Asian descent, Asian plus whatever mixture. But we also know that the Spaniards came, and the Spaniards came and they interbred with them. And we also know that parts of South America, like Argentina, if you look down in Argentina, you'll see that their IQ is 93. And Argentina is actually 86% white people. So Argentina is the cleverest country in South America, except for a very tiny enclave of whites in Brazil, where 88% of the population is white and their IQ is 96. And then you've got Chile, which is on the west coast of South America. It is 89% white and its IQ is 90. And then if you look at the rest of South America, you'll see that their IQs are in the range of 84 up to 88. So the reason that South America is cleverer than Africa is because its original population came from Asia and then it was intermixed with Europeans. So that is where their higher IQ comes from. And you'll see that they are like 20 points higher in IQ than Africa. In Australia, the lowest IQ for Aborigines is 62. And on this map, it shows that in the Kalahari, the Bushmen had the lowest IQ, which is 39. The lowest IQ of any human ever measured is a Kalahari Bushman with 39. And it seems the Bushmen in general have a very low IQ of 54. But as you move up in Africa, you'll start seeing that halfway point between 70 and 100, you'll start seeing it in North Africa, because you're starting to get the racial mixtures of the past. And these racial mixtures have averaged out, sort of between blacks in Africa and whites from Europe. So you'll see that all across North Africa into the Middle East, you're looking at almost an exact midway IQ that is between that of Europeans and that of Africans. And then if you carry on looking into Iran, go towards India, you'll see a similar thing. Now, it could be that in India, the reason India might have such a low IQ might relate to the percentage of northern Indians versus southern Indians. Southern Indians might be more in number, for example. But as you go northwards into Europe, you'll see IQs 98, 99, 100. I think that's the Netherlands with 100, Norway with 100, Iceland with 101. And you'll also see that kind of merger between Europe and Middle East when you get to Turkey. You'll see that clearly the European DNA has had an effect on Turkey, and Turkey's people are cleverer than the rest of the Middle East. China's IQ is rated at 105. I don't always trust statistics that come from China, but we can definitely say that South Korea has got 105. Japan has got 105. Take a look at Mongolia above China and you'll see IQ is 101. That's pretty good. And then if you go down below China, you go to Vietnam, you'll see IQs there are in the 90s. So it's better than India, because clearly it's got that Northeast Asian input, but there is some kind of merger with other kinds of perhaps dark-skinned people. Australia's IQ is 98, New Zealand is 99, America 98, Canada 99. So you can see the results of the movement of whites into marriage with other races and what comes out of it. And all those brown type of countries, they are quite wild. They don't have the same standards as Europe, and the difference between them and Europe is only about 10 to 15 IQ points. When certain civilizations have collapsed, like the Sumerians, which are another ancient civilization, even before Egypt, and they were there in the Middle East, they were in what is now Iraq. When they collapsed, once they collapsed, there was no further development in that region again. The people in these failed multiracial civilizations, those people tend to live life the same way for thousands of years. So the Sumerians, who are several thousand years ago, the lifestyle of the people in that region hasn't changed in thousands of years. Many times when a civilization collapses, it never arises again. The same is true for countries. Once they collapse, they never really arise again. There's clearly a lot of special things that go on into the building up of a country, and among the issues are race and intelligence. And once intelligence starts going down, a place doesn't recover. So with diversity pouring into Europe and America, diversity could have very bad, very long-term effects on those areas. Those IQs can start dropping. Look at India to see what happens when the Aryans are gone, and when others are breeding, and look at how low their IQ is now. Look at Egypt. Egypt was a great civilization for thousands of years. Look at its IQ. It's only 10 points or so, 10 or 12 points above that of Africa. So one of the horrific outcomes of a collapsing civilization is that even when people live in an area that once was great, once was awesome, once was strong, that once that civilization has collapsed, it actually doesn't come back. It never comes back. And like I say, an area where you can see that lesson the clearest is the Middle East. In the northern Middle East, there used to be a nation of whites known as the Hittites. They were very militaristic and they had their own civilization. And the remains of the Hittites can be seen to this day. There is no question that these are European people who lived there. But clearly, they were outbred, they merged away with the people and they disappeared and they're gone. And that's what can happen if you interbreed with another race, is that your race disappears and you're gone. And you end up with this brown race. And you can see this brown race stretching, like I say, from India through to northern Africa and big chunks of South America. So you get this sort of mixed race that is cleverer than the blacks of Africa, but it's nothing like the kind of civilization that came from whites. And that what you need is not only high-quality whites and high-quality people, but you need them in large numbers. You need high-quality people in large numbers. And one of the problems with white people is white people don't have babies. White people don't breed. White people don't have big families. And there is only this tiny little enclave in Northeast Asia where you have lots of high IQ Asians. But it is very interesting that whites have spread more than the Asians, even though the Asians have always been more in number than the whites. I put it down to the fact that whites are militant. Whites have the most militant history of all races. Whites are the most militant and militarized people of all the people on earth. We have the longest standing military traditions of any other race. We fight more and we are more heavily armed. And that is the key reason why we now control more continents than our original homeland. We may have come out of the Caucasus, but we've spread across big chunks of the world. And we've crushed whoever else was there when we came in number. But it's a combination of skill and numbers of people. If you go in tiny numbers, you can run into problems. But look at this map, and I'm sure it will give you lots of food for thought. And if there was any truth to the environmental notion that if people are given a chance to live better, then their IQs will increase. If there was any validity to that notion, then you would have seen it in ancient empires. Then, for example, the Egyptians and others would never have collapsed. They would never have degenerated because they were very functional and they were very, very active and very prosperous. So if success results in higher IQs, then it would mean that success results in nations and empires growing ever stronger. That the stronger you are, the stronger you're going to be. But in actual fact, it doesn't work like that. It works the opposite. Nations and empires seem to always degenerate. And this is especially true of empires where there's large mixtures of people. So it looks as if empires that expand and then bring in lower IQ people then go on to collapse. And once they've collapsed, they're never coming back. So here are some thoughts to ponder about IQ, because IQ, it is not like liberals say that IQ is dependent upon the current situation you're in. 70 or even 80% of IQ comes from your parents when you are born. It is something inside of you, and your DNA is very powerful. And these maps should show you the power of DNA, the power of nature. That the only thing that raises people's IQs, there are only two ways to raise people's IQs. One way to raise IQ naturally is for a lower IQ person to breed with a higher IQ person. But remember, the beneficiary is the lower IQ person. The lower IQ person will now have babies with a higher IQ because they're breeding with somebody who's cleverer than them. The other way to raise IQs is to take people and throw them in a living hell for 40 or 50,000 years, and then the survivors will be very clever. Of course, the lesson for whites could be, do you want to get cleverer? Well, we need harder lives. We need harder lives. Not softer lives, harder lives. Not harder lives for a day or a week. We need harder lives for 10,000 years at least. So, do we want to become cleverer? Maybe we need pain and suffering and lots of hardship, and nature will reward us with higher intelligence. So, you can ponder this map and ponder these things that I've told you, but I've got a few more things to show you quickly before we end this video. I want to show you a little bit more detail of how IQ actually works. This is a comparison of black and white IQ, and you can see it along the bottom, and you'll see where there is 100. They talk about IQ being measured as a bell curve. That's because of the shape that it takes. What this basically tells you is the number of people in the population who have a certain IQ. So for example, if you take the whites and you take the white average, let's say in this particular case, it seems the midpoint is 110. So then you'd say that most whites in this particular comparison have an IQ of 110. But there are less whites who've got an IQ of 100, and there are some whites who've got an IQ of 90, even less have an IQ of 80, and there are some whites who have an IQ of 70 and even 60. But they are very few. Very few whites will have an IQ of 80, but a lot more whites will have an IQ of 100. I actually think that this particular chart is a little bit off. I think the white center point was supposed to be 100, but anyway. So what becomes interesting here in this particular one is there are certain jobs where you need a high IQ. So engineers have to have an IQ of above 120. Doctors have to have an IQ above 140. Researchers above 150, something along those lines. But what you will see is that if you look at the black population and the white population, you'll see that quite a chunk of the white population does have an IQ of 120. However, it is a much smaller percentage of the black population that can get an IQ of 120. So this is also why you can meet blacks who are very clever, but they will just be much rarer among their population. And this bell curve is very important. There is also a slight modification to the bell curve based on male and female, but we're not going to go into that here. It's a very minor difference. It's about 5 IQ points, but it is there as well. So scientists have measured all kinds of things in all kinds of detail, but they don't explain it to you, and the newspapers, etc., don't want you to know about these things and what they mean. So what it means, for example, is you could have a smaller white population that still has a lot more engineers than a bigger black population. That is assuming you stick to the same standards. That is, if you have the same standards. Of course, you could lower your standards and allow yourself to have more engineers, but they're just not going to be the same quality, etc. But anyway, this will give you an idea of the bell curve and what the bell curve means. I just want to show you a little bit about the out of Africa theory, because the liberals and leftists love to crow about this, and they say that it destroys all the arguments of anyone on the white right. But as always, this stuff is just propaganda. Let me show you a few things and you'll see what I mean. So what this map is showing you is that there are 3 species of humans. There's Homo erectus, then there's another species of human that's basically the Neanderthals, and then there's Homo sapiens. So they say that we are all Homo sapiens and we come from Africa. So I just want to deal with what they say and what the science is versus the propaganda, because there's lots of propaganda linked to all of this. And one of my supporters in America in biology is a professor, and he was telling me that even in biology there is a financial agenda, that you can't get certain kinds of research because the powers that be don't support it. So don't imagine that science is totally pure. Science is also sullied by money and people with an anti-white agenda. And one of the things they like to crow about is the out of Africa theory. So let's just take a quick look at this map and I'll explain a couple of things. The Neanderthals, according to this map and according to science, the Neanderthals, that light brown color in Europe and into near Asia, they were there long before the current humans came. In other words, the Neanderthals were there long before our ancestors got there. The Neanderthals lived in Europe 430,000 years ago. Just keep that in the back of your mind when you're looking at this map. So this map shows, and this is what these dates show, this map shows at what point in time Homo sapiens left Africa. So they say Homo sapiens lived in Africa for 200,000 years and then spread off all across the world. And Homo sapiens, the red, spread off into Asia and Europe. And you can see the dates. They got to the Middle East 100,000 years ago. They got to Europe 40,000 years ago. Got to India 70,000 years ago. Got to Australia 50,000 years ago. Got to New Zealand 1,500 years ago. They came across the Bering Strait into America 15,000 years ago. And 12,000 years ago they were crossing America. So they like to say, well, white people are descended from Africa as well, and that our ancestors were basically these black people from Africa. So I just want to deal with the out of Africa theory to start with. This is the current totally popular theory all across science. But whether this theory will always remain the main theory is itself open to question. But I just want to address some of the propaganda that comes from this. So the propaganda is that whites are descended from blacks and therefore we're all the same. But clearly there is something wrong. Because as I've mentioned, our ancestors lived up in the Caucasus Mountains, and so one could guess from this that they probably reached the Caucasus Mountains 80,000 or 60,000 years ago before they headed into Europe. But the problem then is, what about all these dark-skinned people who lived in Africa for 200,000 years? They lived in Africa for 200,000 years in a easygoing climate, which is much warmer than Europe. It has lots more rainfall. It's much easier to live there. They had a 200,000-year head start on Europeans. In fact, they had a 160,000-year head start on the people who became the Europeans, on our ancestors. So if they lived in Africa for 160,000 years in a nice climate, a climate that is far better than Europe, how come they didn't develop the first civilizations? Why didn't they develop the first civilizations? Why weren't they flying in aircraft and going to the moon before the whites or the ancestors of the whites even got to Europe? So the real issue here is, why did these people who had such an enormous head start on everybody else, why didn't they develop anything? Why was it that the actual civilization comes from Europe, the Middle East, near Asia. So that's the one huge elephant sitting in the room. So these liberals are saying, oh no, the whites came from blacks, etc., etc. But, you know, there's the freaking elephant in the room. And that's why I say that scientists like Professor Lin and others have said that the real development took place outside of Africa. So even if our ancestors did come from Africa, their real development took place up there in the Caucasus Mountains, in Russia, in Europe. But there's also another point. These three human species are not actually the only human species. There are others that have gone extinct and they're gone. So the other question, for example, is where did the Neanderthals come from? And how come the Neanderthals lived across Europe and Asia for longer than Homo sapiens was in Africa and anywhere else? Where did the Neanderthals come from? And I'm going to tell you one final thing. The most ancient sort of pre-Homo sapiens people, their skeletons or their remains were found in Africa, and their remains are in the millions of years old. However, there are also remains found in Europe that are millions of years old. So, in other words, this story gets a lot more complicated, and there is a lot more that went on. So don't just think that the Out of Africa theory plus its liberal interpretations means that whites aren't special. Don't buy into that. Whatever happened with our ancestors is the key issue here. Whether our ancestors did or did not come from Africa, it is what happened to them up in the Caucasus Mountains, Asia and Europe. That's where the real development took place, plus also the Middle East. Take a look at this map and you'll see that this does get more complicated, and scientists themselves are still trying to figure out what exactly happened. In actual fact, what this is showing is different theories. So this is by no means as simple as the Out of Africa theory. This shows, for example, in this pink color, it shows multiple waves dispersal model. And then it's got a single wave dispersal model. But then take a look at some of these arrows. You then get arrows that say that there are people that came back into Africa, that people left Africa, but that people then came back into Africa. And again, we are left with the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room being, why is it that all progress takes place outside of Africa? It's taking place outside of Africa. People may leave Africa, but the progress in human civilization and in IQ is taking place outside of Africa. They might have found skeletons and remains of humans inside of Africa, but all of civilization and progress takes place outside of Africa. Exactly as I've been explaining to you as per Richard Lin and others. So the great big elephant in the room remains, why does progress take place outside of Africa? And I repeat, it's to do with hardship. Science is actually extremely precise. European science is exceptionally precise. precise. But as always, the mass media and certain people don't want you to know some of the things that would be scientifically true. Here is a meme that somebody did. I've actually got a bunch of memes that people did some years ago, and they all tell a similar story, and they're very excellent. If science were to be applied properly to humans, then the result would be quite shocking, actually. We are told that all humans are the same. But science is exceptionally precise, and there are many, many, many examples like what you see in this meme. For example, those two giraffes, to you they look just like a giraffe, but scientifically they've been classified as two different subspecies of giraffes. So scientists don't look on those two giraffes as being exactly the same. They are specific subspecies. In this example, somebody took tigers. So here is a Malayan tiger on the left and a Sumatran tiger on the right. Again, scientists have looked at those two animals and they have done detailed analysis as to what is exactly different between those two animals. And so from a scientific point of view, those are two different subspecies and they are treated as such. However, that is never done to humans. But it used to be, when the issues and topics of race started coming to the fore 150 or so years ago, people started looking at humans as races and sub-races. But that has been stopped. And it's been stopped because the end result would be, let's call it, very racist. I did a video about a book written by an American liberal professor called Professor Quigley. He wrote a number of books, but a really important book, which we will revisit, is The Evolution of Civilizations. Professor Quigley actually states in his book, The Evolution of Civilizations, near the end, he quietly tells you that science does not get applied to humans the way it should be. In other words, if we treated all humans as animals and we treated them according to the same rules by which we define animals, different species of animals, different subspecies of animals, if we applied what we do in science with animals, if we applied that to humans, we would end up with lots and lots of different types of humans. I would suspect that we'd probably end up with hundreds of subspecies of different types of humans, of different types of races of humans. But because of politics, that is not allowed. But that is also not scientific. So the truth of the matter is that when it comes to race, it has been deliberately suppressed. Proper science has been deliberately suppressed with respect to humans. They just quietly pretend that all humans are the same when in fact they know in tremendous detail every single difference between them all. So that little meme, there's a lot more of that. And you can go and look it up yourself. And you can go and look at subspecies of animals and you'll see what I mean. You'll see how extremely precise science is in everything except when it suddenly affects humans. Then the politicians come out and they tell the scientists to shut up and stop doing science. because science would be racist. So what I'm going to end off with is this quote from Dr. James Watson. This is the white scientist who's basically the father of DNA. DNA is amazing and incredible, and its precision to yet another insane level of awesomeness. And so here is Dr. James Watson, who's won a Nobel Prize, and he says, "All our social aid policies to Africa are based on the delusion that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says not really. Changes in our respective lineages," in other words, our ancestors, "let us begin to understand how human beings have evolved. There is no firm reason to anticipate that the intellectual capacities of people geographically separated in their evolution should prove to have evolved identically." He's just basically saying there, in a nice way, that if your race evolved in a different geographical location, that your IQ cannot be expected to be the same. It's that simple. As I've tried to explain with the issues about the ice ages, the skin color, etc., that scientists have concluded that the thing that started setting people apart, even if everybody originally came out of Africa, even if that is the case, the bottom line is that 40 or 50,000 years in the ice age changes you totally. And that's what happened to us. And if we return to Dr. William Pierce, I will repeat what Dr. William Pierce says. Dr. William Pierce said, "I believe in the real world, the unforgiving world of nature, in which we evolved through hard and bloody struggle over millions of years. Perhaps it is not a nice world, but it still can be a beautiful world if one looks at it with the right attitude." So what science is telling us is that the only reason that we are cleverer than the others is because we lived, or rather our ancestors lived, through hell. Our ancestors struggled, died, and battled for their existence for tens of thousands of years. And that extreme hardship and letting the weak die off and letting the stupid die off and others working and struggling and so on and developing tools and methods to survive in the Ice Age, that is what made us what we are. So the truth is that out of science, being nice to people doesn't help anyone. If you want to go forward, you need to live through hardship, struggle, suffering, but serious hardship and serious suffering and serious struggle, and not just for a day or a week or 8 hours, but for tens of thousands of years. That is what makes you awesome. And that is why the European race is awesome. Nobody loved us. We had to struggle and fight and battle on, and our ancestors had to live through insane nightmares. And that is why we're awesome. And if we want to remain awesome or become more awesome, the rules are very simple. Rule number one, breed a lot, because IQ is inherited. Breed a lot with your own people. live in extreme hardship and test yourself to the limits of the limits. And you must live under extreme duress, and you must do things to the absolute utmost. And if you want to gain more territory, be militant. Be militant and be as militant as you possibly can be. And when you are competing with another race in the same area, you need to either breed a lot or bring in a lot of your own people. You need numbers. And look also now at how much of the world is the result of whites interbreeding with other races. Look at how much breeding we've done with other races all over the show. And what happened to us? Well, in certain cases, we bred ourselves out of existence. In other cases, we mixed with other people to create a new race or new subspecies. And is that subspecies helping us? No, they are competing with us. They are fighting against us. We don't have control over them. At the end of the day, all that you have is what you physically occupy with your own people. That's all that you have. And if you go and you start interacting with others and either breeding yourself out of existence completely or merging with others, the end result is not helping us. So now we are outnumbered by lots and lots and lots of other people, and they can threaten you. And they are now a separate power, and they are no longer part of you. So when you go and you breed outside your race, it's a waste of time. You're actually strengthening others, and it will ultimately backfire on your own people. The only reason we're here is because our ancestors stuck to those rules. Liberalism and diversity is not good for the European race. And you can see the end results of it after many adventures on many continents. And furthermore, what does it do for civilization and for our civilization? It does nothing. Those are the rules. Breed a lot, live in intense hardship, and face hardship intensely to the maximum all the time, and be as militant as possible. And if you do those things, whites will never have a survival problem, ever. Nature does not reward you through love. Nature rewards you through hardship. And you really have to live through intense hardship. Nature does not feel sorry for anybody. And those who lived the soft life, like those in Africa, how far did they get? What did they walk away with? Ponder these things and you will know how the universe really works. It's a tough place. Let's just say that nature operates on tough love, but the toughest love you can imagine.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites! the white. You know you're going.